Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Power Hungry Podcast. I'm Robert Bryce. On this podcast, we talk about energy, power, innovation, and politics. And I'm pleased to welcome, after an extended delay, my new friend Edgardo Sepulveda. He is a Toronto-based independent consulting economist, and we're going to talk about the politics and the issues around nuclear power and nuclear deployment. Edgardo, welcome to the Power Hungry Podcast.
Fantastic to be able to join you. I've been a longtime fan, Robert, so it's great to be on this podcast.
Well, that's great. It took us a while to make it happen, but now we're going to make some more podcast magic. So if you've listened to the Power Hungry Podcast before, you know that guests introduce themselves. So I've given you kind of a general introduction as an independent consulting economist and a Canadian at that. Imagine you're arrived at a party or somewhere and you don't know anyone and you have 60 seconds to identify yourself. Please do so.
Sure. Thank you. My name is Edgardo Sepulveda. I am an economist by training, a longtime resident of Toronto, Canada. I'm an immigrant. I was born in Chile. First language is Spanish. And I've been working on regulatory economics for about 35 years now. Initially with one of the telecom companies here in Toronto, and then independent consulting, and then about 7 or 8 years ago, got into the energy space. And so the rest is history, as they say.
Well, I didn't know you were from Chile. I was going to guess maybe Spain, but since you mentioned Chile, let's start there, because Chile has been one of the success stories, or nominally so, in South America as a country that liberalized their economy, embraced capitalism and freer markets. Now, it's been tension back and forth, but relative to Argentina, Chile's been relative to Argentina, a lot of places are success stories. Talk about Chile for just a minute before we dive into nuclear power economics. I'm just curious, since you mentioned that, what did Chile do? Who instigated that? It's widely, I think, credited to the American economist. Who was it that they followed his lead? But what happened?
Milton Friedman.
Thank you. Brain freeze there. Milton Friedman. What happened in Chile that allowed it to be one of the better, more successful countries in South America?
This is an interesting topic, especially when it comes to electricity, Robert, because one of the things that we'll be talking about, in the podcast will be about restructuring of the electricity markets in the United States and elsewhere.
Or deregulation, right? Or some, depending on... Ken Lay called it restructuring from Enron.
Yeah, that's right.
His word was restructuring, right? But
that's right.
It's all somehow treating the move toward electricity as a commodity rather than a monopoly, right?
Yeah. And so that's exactly it. And then we'll be talking about ownership. And so one of the things that, and all of this has long history,
right.
and some of it, as far as I've been able to track, in that respect, Chile was a leader in that respect. It was one of the first ones to be subject to this kind of restructuring or liberalization, deregulation of the electricity sector. Now, one of the things we're going to be talking about is that in the U.S. and in Canada and around the world, especially sort of since the mid-1990s and onwards, these have been fundamentally political processes that have been responding to a particular political economy, and ultimately laws passed through democratically elected governments. The contrast in Chile is that this is done under dictatorship, and it was done basically at the end of the gun. And one of the things that the economists within the military regime there took one of the things from Milton Friedman and some of the others. They were called the Chicago Boys, right, after having studied at the University of Chicago. Very neoliberal, very conservative, very pro-market. Was that they were probably the first country in the world that started to split generation from transmission distribution and started to create markets for generation assets and ultimately privatized. So this was in early 80s and kind of was finalized in sort of mid to late 80s. And then, you know, this was the model. And that model was ultimately then implemented in the UK under Margaret Thatcher. And then ultimately, you know, it came to North America, right, where, you know, many states, as we'll discuss, and a number of provinces here in Canada actually went through this model that had been kind of test driven in Chile, then kind of perfected in the UK, and ultimately, you know, arrived on these shores.
You know, I didn't know that history, but that Chile, it went Chile. I knew it was Britain, then to the US, right? And Enron was a leader in both in the UK restructuring and then in California, then in Texas, and this idea about electricity as a commodity rather than a service, which is one, right, of the things that I think is one of the key corrupting factors or key things that has made electricity the electricity sector, I'm almost said market there.
Yeah.
I see Isaac Orr from the Center for the American Experience says there's no such thing as a free market in electricity. But let's, right, jump to that, because you've just recently written a piece for your website, edcarb.org. That's edcarb.org. About this issue of public ownership and nuclear power. It's headlined, "Will more U.S. nuclear advocates support increased public ownership and or re-regulation?" And I think this is a key point, because it, you know, I'm very pro-nuclear, and I know you are as well, but I'm also very sober about the potential for nuclear in the United States to succeed, particularly, mm-hmm, in states like Texas or California, where you don't have a stronger government role. So talk about, well, first tell us why you did this analysis, because you, mm-hmm, you obviously put quite a lot of time into it, looking at the history of ownership in 2008 and then in 2004 and the change over that time period. And you clearly show an increase in public ownership versus the areas where the privatized or deregulated markets. What set you out, what set you off to do this kind of analysis?
Well, it's basically what I do for work, except this is pro bono. This is all volunteer. And so, you know, as a regulatory economist, you know, we especially within in network industries such as telecoms, such as electricity, you know, we look at, we're not engineers. Right. So we're not going to look at, you know, reactor designs. We're not going to look at the safety. You know, I have a sort of peripheral understanding of all of that. But my area, what we do is we look at the underlying economics of the industry and, right, what drives the industry. And one of the fundamental parameters that we study is markets and ownership. I mean, this, right, is fundamentally, if you go back to Adam Smith, right, you know, sort of one of the forefathers of the economics, I mean, he was all about markets, governance, and ownership, right? Right. And so we always look at that. I'm a nuclear advocate. And so I was, you know, since getting into the energy space 7 or 8 years ago, I started looking at, you know, the great, sometimes heroic and sometimes victorious, but sometimes, you know, there was defeat from U.S. advocates on specific nuclear reactors, whether it be Indian Point, whether it be, you know, Diablo Canyon, Palisades, etc. And then you kind of, from an economist's perspective, you start thinking, well, let's try to connect the dots. Like, yeah, these are specific, let's call it tactical battles, right? These are all specific things we're trying to save us. But, you know, you start thinking, what do they have in common? Well, you know, California restructured, Diablo Canyon, 100% PG&E owned, you know, and then you go Indian Point, New York, restructured, you know, 100%, you know, privately owned. And then you go, where are things getting built? Well, what's bar to Tennessee, traditional, 100% public. Right. And so, you know, so you go, okay, well, I wonder if anyone's done this. And I looked in the literature, and no one had done it. And so 200 hours later of digging through, you know, electricity reports from the EIA, and going back to 2008 and going reactor by reactor, what is the ownership structure of that reactor? How has that changed? Is it still operating from 2008 to 2024, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? You know, you're able to do this data analysis that is able to parse out whether by public ownership, private ownership. And one of the interesting things I found that I wasn't aware of before is that a lot of them are mixed ownership.
Yeah, right.
Like South Texas, like Vogel, right? Like a lot of these things where you've got an operating company such as, Georgia Power, and then you've got a series of, this is in Vogel, then you've got a series of, for example, small municipalities or co-ops.
Right.
That they basically do, you can think of it as a small, as an SMR, whereby you take a share, an equity share, right, of the actual reactor to be able to spread, you know, not be fully exposed. And I think that's the same thing with South Texas, with the city of Austin.
Right. And the city of San Antonio, but the plant is operated by NRG, or no, they just changed ownership. Who was it that... bought it. It changed ownership. But the punchline here, if I can cut to that, because I'm looking at your report that was published on January 27th, and you find that between 2008 and 2024, the capacity, that is all of the, in terms of gigawatts, in the restructured states fell by 10%, but in traditional states, it grew by almost 3% or 2.7%. So there is a clear change when you look at this, and I take all your points about, well, these are not exact definitions, right? You have a restructured state like Texas, but city of Austin, city of San Antonio own big shares of the South Texas project. So there's differences in ownership, and we can talk about how, you know, nuanced we want to be. Mm-hmm. But the point here, I think, that you're getting to, if I'm not mistaken, is, and the way I see it, I'll just give you my... I'll ask it as the way I'm supposed to be asking questions.
Sure.
Is strong government ownership, strong government participation, strong government oversight and involvement in these electricity sectors, is that essential for nuclear to succeed?
The evidence says yes. And so it was not clear that, it was not clear. Because one of the things you've got to, you know this, most outside of the United States, most nuclear has traditionally, even to this day, being publicly owned, certainly built under, whether it's, EDF in France,
Rosatom in Russia.
Rosatom, these are all very large, public enterprises. Built in, let's call it, traditional markets, and so in that sense, the U.S. was a bit of an outlier in terms of that. Its existing nuclear fleet was primarily private, and so so it's not that private ownership versus public ownership is necessarily the driving force. United States being an example, but in combination, and this is the sort of the hypothesis, Robert, in combination with restructured markets,
right?
That is what I found to be that combination to be very detrimental.
Right.
Not only for the maintenance,
so you can have private ownership, but if it's in a traditional market or a non-restructured market, then those reactors could have a better chance of succeeding. And I think you say it pretty well here right at the end. The aim of this blog, you say, was to show a particular political economy has been detrimental to nuclear in the U.S. The
right.
prescription to support increased public ownership and re-regulation, however, may be too bitter a pill for most U.S. nuclear advocates. But I got to tell you, we're on the same page here, and took us a while to get together and talk about this, but I think that you're right. You look around the world at China, which is building now more nuclear reactors than any other country in the world. And there's distant, India might be the distant second place.
Right.
And India, but India as well, Russia, France, South Korea, UAE. These places are where the government is heavily involved in the ownership, in the construction, in the finance, in all of these aspects. They're saying this is a public good. And I think that is, even economists would use that. That's this service, this industry, this network is a public good. And we have to be very much more involved. But so then let's look at the U.S. Let me ask you this. So where can nuclear, Vogel was, let's be clear, a mixed success, right?
Yep.
Incredible cost overruns, over time, over budget by about twice. Can nuclear succeed anywhere in the U.S.? I mean, are you bullish on it in the U.S.? What do you think needs to happen in the United States for new nuclear power plants of any size, gigawatt, SMR, name it? Where can they, what is going to be needed to make them work here?
Yeah. And so look, what we see is, first of all, I mean, this has been in the United States, as it has been in Canada, which is sort of one of the reasons that I'm still kind of, very, very pleased with the events of the last two or three days in Canada, which we'll talk about. Yeah. But in Canada and United States, where we've had basically stable electricity demand, so we're not growing, right? And the idea that, you're going to invest billions of dollars in like a generation asset, like a nuclear reactor or nuclear plant, that's going to take you, best case scenario, 4 or 5 years, worst case scenario, 10 years to build. And you're going to be able to, you're not going to be able to recover those costs like wind, 3 or 4 years, or like solar in, whatever, even less, or in a, in a natural, in a gas generation plant in maybe 5 or 6 years. You're not going to be able to recover your investment in maybe 10, 15, 20 years.
Right.
So one of the things that's driving generally in the West, the slowdown, of nuclear builds, or the almost zero nuclear builds. This is why we're seeing it in Dubai, where we're seeing it in China, where we're seeing in Russia, especially in China, which is growing, is that it's very difficult, whether it's for a government or for a private entity, Robert, to be able to invest in a generation asset that's going to go for 50 years when you're uncertain about demand. You could build it and maybe they won't come, right? And so there's a risk associated with that. And so that's why we see in Ontario, for example, potential builds that were programmed for the early 2000s. And at the time, sort of the state enterprise or the government were saying, I don't know if I can do this because I don't know if I'm going to have demand. And it's going to be a white elephant where we're going to be selling it, demand, we're not going to need it. And as you know, electricity has to be fine balanced. If you have too much capacity, you're burdening, you're burdening consumers with higher than necessary costs. If you don't have enough capacity, you're in a situation of potential blackouts, right? And so, that idea of the right balance has always been, these are challenging times because of lack of traditional historical growth under which the U.S. nuclear fleet was constructed in the 60s, 70s, 80s.
Where we had high single digit growth or even double digit growth for years.
That's exactly it.
For years in a row. So the risk then, because these are such long lived assets, the risks are such, whether it is on the demand side, or you didn't mention cost of capital, but that's the other part that the government is going to have to step in and say, well, we'll take the risk because we got deep pockets and we see this as a long-term investment that is a societal good.
That's exactly it.
But in the restructured markets or these deregulated markets, you know, the companies, the corporate bosses, and this is not a criticism, it's just the reality. They're looking at the return on their invested capital and they're saying, well, we've got a 3 or 5 year horizon. If we don't have any clarity about that, we're out. Well, why else would you build nuclear? We're only going to build solar and wind because, especially now with the tax credits, you'd be an idiot to build anything else. I mean, that's just the fact, I think.
That's exactly it. And so even private, even public under those situations would be a real tough going, right? And so you contrast that to Vogtle, or you contrast that to, you know, OPG here in Ontario, where you have a rate base, and the rate base, you know, for our listeners, it basically says that there's a regulatory compact with, you know, your regulatory agency. You know, it would be the Georgia Public Service Commission. Here it's called the OEB, where basically you say, you know, I'm going to, for a return of providing this service, the regulatory agency, the economic regulatory agency, again, economic, not the safety, the economic regulation, will allow you to recover those costs over the long run. Right. Yeah. And so under that situation, whether it's private investment or public investment, you know that you're going to be able to recover those costs over 50, 60 years or 30 years, as the case may be. You're not required through spot pricing, which is what we, you know, those restructured markets do, spot pricing, where it doesn't guarantee you next day's prices.
Right.
You know, it guarantees you maybe in the next 5 minutes of pricing. So there's no guarantee of the return on investment there. And then you've got all, as you said, all the other out of market revenues that people are recovering through tax credits, you know, and the rest of the other things.
So if we're going to boil that down, Edgardo, then we're talking about by having more government involvement. You know, it's kind of the nuance here, you know, is direct accountability to the Public Utility Commission and setting rates. By having more government ownership and involvement, you're reducing the political risk and the capital risk, right? Which the market risk, I guess, really, it's the market risk, which is capital risk, right? It's the same in some ways, but those are all three are connected, right? Political capital and the market risks, right? That ownership by having government involvement, you don't eliminate those risks, but you're easier to socialize them, I guess. How would you describe that?
That's right. I mean, what you're doing is one of the things that, you know, this liberalization restructuring that occurred, you know, in the late 1990s, early 2000s was a recomposition of the incentives. And so you're aligning basically, your sector in such a way that you were driven by short-term auctions, spot auctions.
Right.
And so your alignment and the way in which you're going to be compensated for those short-term options basically was all on short-term returns.
Right.
And so short-term returns aren't really conducive to long-term investment. And so there was a misalignment between the types of, you know, generation assets like nuclear that have particular kind of capital characteristics that are not conducive to the short-term spot markets. Ultimately, what we're looking for, whether we're building highways, whether we're building airports, whether we're building dams, whether we're building nuclear plants, is we're looking for patient capital. And if markets and the rules of the markets are not conducive to aligning that patient capital with those societal wishes as to what you want out of the sector, those two are not going to be are in conflict. And so therefore, we see the market responding to that over the last, you know, 16 years, whereby in markets that have been restructured to promote short-term thinking rather than patient capital, What we see is an exit by private capital from those markets. And what we see is 5 gigawatts of, you know, in 16 years, retire, exit in the United States.
Right.
In contrast,
I like that. The summary kind of, if I'm going to read it back to you, is this: you have to have alignment of patient capital with societal good, right? And you mentioned airports, dams,
highways.
Highways, libraries, you know, there's no return on investment in libraries, I don't think, but they're a societal good. I love libraries, but is that the right way to think about it? Is that the aligning the incentives for patient capital so that you meet societal goods? Is that a proper way to phrase it?
I like it. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just thought of it now and, you know, with your help and I think that's the way to think about it. And so,
and that necessarily requires government.
It necessarily requires government because let's not forget sort of where we are now in the restructured market. I mean, the experiment, Robert, to go towards restructured markets, which is relatively new historically, it's only the last 20 years. For the first 100 years of the electricity sector, government in the United States and elsewhere was extremely involved, right? Every single state of the 50 states had a public service commission,
right?
Had a PUC, you know, a public utilities commission. And we had a situation where, you know, the electricity sector helped us give us the modernity that we see around it. It was an extremely successful model, right? And so, you know, the revolutionaries, in a sense, were the free marketeers, the Enronites, the Kenneth Lays, who said, you know, like 20 years ago, think about what it meant. It's one of those things that's amazing. Like you're basically an industry that has grown doubled, basically, that is the driving force of modernity. And suddenly, you know, whether, first of all, again, at the end of a gun in Pinochet's Chile, then under Margaret Thatcher, and then in the U.S., basically people said, you know what, we don't care about if it ain't broke, you know, don't fix it. We're actually going to break it, and we're going to have this experiment where and think about, you know, when you think about sort of free markets and lack of government involvement, think of the government involvement, Robert, where in these 16 states that I identify in the blog, in assemblies, in state assemblies, in state senates, and ultimately signed by the state governor, not because there was an antitrust problem, which had been the case of Standard Oil when it was broken up in 1911, or AT&T when it was broken up by the Department of Justice in 1982-84, because of antitrust, there's no problem. But basically, they said, you know what? Forget about your property rights. We're actually going to unbundle you. We're going to require you to separate yourself. And we're going to unbundle the generation asset. And not only that, but we're going to also federalize the system.
Right.
These are state-controlled, state-regulated regulatory entities that gave up power to FERC for those RTOs and the generation assets. So you've got two things that were truly revolutionary. You're having basically the elimination of certain property rights by requiring the selling of your generation assets for companies that had often been, you know, in existence for 100 years by state legislation. And then the state's basically giving up power, the authority, the responsibility, and bringing it up to the federal government. So that was truly a revolutionary process that I'm still amazed that, you know, people got away with it. They were very ambitious. There was a huge free market process. There were a lot of money involved, and everyone was involved. I mean, you're familiar with this. And sure. They persuaded both Democrats and Republicans, right, 50-50, to do this.
Right.
To break up their own industries. And so you're thinking
Republicans about... And the Republicans did it because they liked this idea of the free market, and the Democrats did it because companies like Enron could go to the Sierra Clubbers and the solar and wind guys and say, see, we're going to give you a way to get into the market.
Exactly.
And so there's a great, there's a quote from this is speaking of that very time period now. I just want to find this one. It was St. Patrick's Day, 1999. So almost exactly 25 years ago. And there was the debate in the Texas legislature about this restructuring that Enron was pushing. And there's this great quote from Senator David Sibley, who was from Waco, Texas. Now, Waco, Texas is not a bastion of liberalism. And he says, on the Senate floor, he says, starting in 2002, people will be able to shop. If they don't like the electric provider they've got, they can switch, he said. If the price of a can of beans goes up 10 cents, people shop elsewhere. Shop somewhere else. If the price of electricity goes up, people for the first time will have a choice on what they're going to do. It's no more business as usual. So, but this idea of electricity as beans, goddamn, no, wrong. It ain't beans, Senator. And to call it beans just is this indicative of this kind of misunderstanding and misapprehension of what the thing is. But it's like you said, it's this uniting of the free market guys with the liberals and, oh, we're going to make it greener and Enron and this corporatism and all of this thing coming together to throw overboard what had been a very successful model for more than a century. I mean, I love that quote, right, about that whole thing, but it's the specter of Enron still is haunting electric markets now 23 years after the company went bust.
Yeah. And so what we have, and, you know, again, I'm not the first person to comment. I'm the first person to comment on the nuclear side, Robert. But, you know, I mean, both academic and policy economists have been looking at, you know, what we often don't have in economics is a natural experiment, right? Like,
right,
we're usually having to compare an actual reality to a potential other reality and kind of be able to compare across those two states. But in the case of the United States, we actually have a pretty good natural experiment, which is that, you know, 16, 17, 18 states restructured, the others didn't. And so you can compare performance, right? And so that's where I was kind of, that was my inspiration, is that we have these natural experiments and you can do a back-to-back comparison and it's pretty valid. And so, you know, economists have been looking at investment, have been looking at price, have been looking at reliability, comparing across these two models, right? And to be able to say, this one's doing well, this one's not doing well. And across the board, the great promises of the restructured markets have just not borne fruit. Prices are not lower. You know, investment is not higher, right? And so people were sold a bill of goods, as we say here in Canada. People were sold a bill of goods. And now, sort of, how do you go back? And so there are, how do you go back? How do you put Humpty Dumpty together again? Right? Right? Like, how do you do that? And so there are initiatives, as I mentioned. I mean, even people within FERC commissioners are talking about how this experiment, partial experiment, because a lot of states did not do that.
Yeah.
Florida, you know, most of the Southeast did not.
Right.
Georgia didn't. Much of the Midwest did not. And they're happy. They're happy. There's no push for them to go restructure. All they have to do is look at, like, you know, Texas. They have to look at California. They have to look at New York. And they go, no, thank you. I'm glad I didn't. I'm glad I resisted at the time. And I don't want to go there. So there are initiatives. There is a small hubbub of policy wonks and academics and policymakers that are saying, listen, this was not good. It did not turn out. And so one of my humble calls is for nuclear advocates to start to get interested in that process.
Yeah.
Because it's not only good for the sector, it's good for nuclear.
Yeah.
And so that's why my question, a little provocative, is will more US nuclear advocates support public ownership and re-regulation? Is because there is a push right now in the US, as there is in Canada, but in the US, for public power. But it's mostly coming from proponents of or advocates of wind and solar, right? Yeah. Whether they're pushing in New York, whether they're pushing, there was a referendum in Maine, that's coming from wind and solar, because what do they want? They want to the state to socialize or monopolize the company in order to get more wind and solar.
But so, you know, again, and I think that's a good point, and it's a really interesting one. My read of why they're pushing for that, the wind and solar crowd, is they want to be able to condemn private land for their wind and solar projects. I think that that is fundamentally about property and the expansion of the amount of land that they need now.
Right.
Maybe it's couched for other reasons, but I think it's fundamentally about land use, right? That they don't have that power to condemn the property. And now there are a lot of democratic states that are trying to do an end run around that.
Ah, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So let's talk about, well, first, I want to talk about Pickering, and then let's come back to Indian Point. So we're here in early February, and just in the last few days, another big win for pro-nuclear people in Canada with the announcement from Ontario Power Generation to refurbish the nuclear reactors at Pickering. You and Chris Kiefer and all the other pro-nuclear folks in Canada, you're kicking ass. I mean, it's been pretty impressive. Canada is now clearly leading the world when it comes to the nuclear comeback. How important was this decision by OPG to go back into Pickering and refurbish those reactors?
Oh, it was, you know, I mean, look, the shovels are not in the ground, stuff hasn't been ordered. So we just gotta be careful that, you know, these things, but there is now a political announcement by the province, by the Ministry of Energy, that did the photo op there, Chris Kiefer and a bunch of other colleagues from Canadians for Nuclear Energy, which is sort of the advocacy group that's been pushing for this for 3-4 years, wrote the report, et cetera, et cetera. There was an announcement made. So just in terms of, for our listeners that aren't familiar with the nuclear sector in Ontario, we are kind of like France and kind of like Illinois, I believe it's Illinois, are sort of one of the few jurisdictions in the world that is, more than 50% nuclear.
Right.
We will, depending on the year, we're at 55-60%. And that is, we have 18 nuclear reactors that are operational, and all of them were publicly built. Apropos our discussion, Robert, they're all publicly built. They're all CANDU reactors, particular technology of reactors. And they're in three plants, three locations. So that's Darlington, Bruce, and Pickering. Right. And so the Pickering had two reactors, A and B. A was the oldest. They were built in the early 70s, and they're the oldest technology. But B was built in the 1980s, and so they're now running for 40 years.
Yeah,
and so the refurbishment basically means, in super simplistic terms, is you're taking out the guts and maintaining the chassis, right? And that's because of safety and other issues with the brittlement, given sort of the high pressure radioactive environment within the guts of the reactor. This has already been done in both Darlington and Bruce. Those are combined $28 billion refurbishments over 15 years.
Right.
And so the advocacy was, we got to save Pickering, because it's now running to the, if it's end of its prescribed life. And so could we persuade the province, and specifically OPG, which is the provincial entity that actually operates the company, the reactors, could we persuade them to, instead of doing something else, because we are starting to increase potential growth of electricity. This is the big change compared to 15 years ago, when the decision was taken not to refurbish because we had flat growth. We were in the middle of the 2008-2009 recession. you know, we were actually decreasing in electricity demand rather than potential for increasing. Now, with EVs, we've attracted in Ontario three large battery car battery plants, Stellantis, VW.
Right.
We are transferring our steel making to electric arc furnaces. And we're expecting a very significant demographic growth. So for all of these reasons, for the first time, realistically, we're going to have, we're not going to go back to the seven or eight percent per year growth, but we're maybe going up to 2.5 to 3%, which right. is better than what we've been doing over the last 20 years, which is, you know, flatlining, right? And so in this context, we're starting to realize from a planning perspective that we're going to need more juice.
Right.
And so then you start thinking, well, what are my alternatives? Do I want to build new stuff, including intermittent, you know, renewables, or do I want to refurbish this, you know, this nuclear plant that has been performing very well, and that's going to provide us with clean, reliable baseload power, right? At a regulated rate.
Right.
Right. Because remember, OPG is regulated by the Ontario Electricity, Ontario Electricity Board, Energy Board. So that's the lead in, and they've now committed to doing it. And so what they're going to be doing is starting in probably in 3 or 4 years. I mean, the commitments now, they've put up $2 billion to do a lot of the prep work, engineering design, et cetera, et cetera. And if everything goes well, they're going to start the actual refurbishment, you know, in 3 or 4 years. And they're going to be having all four of them operating by probably early 2030s, mid 2030s. And they're going to be running, Robert, they're going to be running for 30, 35, 40 years after that, right? So they're going to be running from 2035 to 2075. Yeah. And you know, but they're going to be providing that kind of.
But it's a big win. It's a big win for this. To recap what you're saying, how I didn't reread it back to you is this idea of long-term thinking. No, we're going to plan for the future. You know, that we know this is what we're going to need. We're taking the long view. And that is one of the key issues, I think, in the U.S. utility set. One of the many, right? We have 3,000 different electricity providers in America, which is just a stunning number, right? It's incredibly diffused, the whole ownership. But the long-term view, that is a difficult thing to get across in America amidst all these other challenges. But I think that's great. And I mean, you know, really, it solidifies Canada's position, in my view, as I think it's objectively true now. Outside of China, Canada is the country in the world now that has been the most aggressive in its announcements that it is going to embrace nuclear and expand nuclear and be very clear about that. And I'd say it's Ontario more specifically than Canada in general. So let's just jump back to the U.S. for a minute, because we've talked about restructured markets and you talked about New York. And I quick station break again. If you're not, they didn't get the earlier introduction. My guest is Edgardo Sepulveda. He's a Toronto-based consulting economist who usually works on telecom, but made the big mistake of getting into electricity. And you can find his work and what we're talking about here, this really terrific analysis that he did on decarbonization and U.S. nuclear growth on his website, edecarb.org. That's edecarb.org. He's also on Twitter at @E_R_Sepulveda. Okay, but you list Indian Point here, and I'm still seething about the closure of Indian Point. Entergy did it, but to your point, who built Indian Point? Who built those power plants? It was the New York Power Authority, and effectively gave them away for a song to Entergy. Entergy ran them for a few years and then decided they were facing some problems. Well, they're facing a lot of litigation from those idiots at Riverkeeper and those bigger idiots at Natural Resources Defense Council. And they found another willing idiot in Andrew Cuomo. Not that I'm bitter, but they closed that plant, both the final reactor in 2021. And what has happened in New York? Power prices have gone up. CO2 emissions have gone up, and their reliance on natural gas fired generation has increased. All of it was predictable. All of it was well known. They're not building offshore wind because it's too incredibly too expensive. And it's just but it seems that you have it. It's the first plant that you list here in one of your graphics or one of your tables here on the restructured markets. So I've given you my splenectomy here, splenetic analysis of Indian Point. Why did Indian Point close?
Well, look, the reason I pointed out was I didn't focus on Indian Point specifically, other than to point out that the New York Power Authority, basically in that fervor to liberalize, 2 years after New York restructured,
right?
New York Power Authority said, "I'm getting rid of this because it's basically a merchant. It's going to be a merchant, reactor, and we don't like our chances." And so, and there was also pressure from
the state government,
state assembly, et cetera, which ultimately has political control of whether it's NYPA or any of the other, like in Ontario, right? So, I mean, you've got to be careful about, and people are rightly cautious about political control and public ownership for those very reasons, right? So it's not that this is like nothing ever bad happens under the situation. Is that certain characteristics of nuclear, and without having to repeat it, you take your pros and cons and you take your balance, right?
Right.
And so what happened in Indian Point was, there was litigation, but also ultimately, a private company will take the litigation if they can think they can make the money.
Right.
Right? I mean, we know this, right? You put it into your cost of doing business. And if you think that you can do it, or if you think that you've got, another one where you can make money, like Fitzpatrick, right? So the NYPA sold Indian Point 3 and Fitzpatrick to Entergy, I think it was. Fitzpatrick continues, right? And from what I understand, the deal with Cuomo was that I'll shut down Indian Point and I'll keep Fitzpatrick.
Right.
That was the quid pro quo.
Yeah.
That from the political process was, I need to shut this one down, because if you don't shut this down, I'll shut both of them down. Right. So there was political pressure. So the idea that there's no political pressure on private enterprise is also naive.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And so, but had they been a regulated, and this is the comparison, Robert. Had this been a regulated entity where they were guaranteed their a fair rate of return based on a cost of service regulation, maybe they could have held out. I don't know.
Yeah.
But again, those are the tactical battles on a reactor by reactor. We're being defensive from a nuclear advocacy. We're trying to save
onesies and twosies, like in Illinois, Michigan, or
that's
was
exactly
in Indian
it.
Point.
And so,
instead of a broader sensibility about this is the technology we know works. This is the technology we need to get behind,
and we need to change the rules.
Yeah,
but
therein lies the problem, because then you've got to put your thumb on. I mean, that's what they did in New York. They put the thumb on the scale and made out of market payments to the upstate nuclear plants to keep them open. But they wouldn't provide out of market payments to the downstate reactors at Indian Point.
Right.
And there's the issue here in Texas. So I had Jimmy Glotfelty, who's a sitting member of the Public Utility Commission here in Texas. He's been charged by Governor Abbott to head this working group on new nuclear in Texas. And I challenged him on this. I said, well, how are you going to make this work? Oh, well, we have various ways to do it. Well, the very short answer is, in the Texas market, an energy-only market, they're going to have to create some kind of out-of-market thing to put the thumb on the scale of nuclear to say, this is the kind of generation we want here. I mean, it seems to me that simple. Or am I missing something?
No, that's exactly it. I mean, that's the way in which, wind and solar have increased in the United States. primarily through those subsidies in out of market, right?
Yeah.
Yes, of course, out of market to save a particular, you know, nuclear plant or promote new nuclear, great. But I mean, that's an incrementalism to right. trying to patch things over when systemic risk exists. And that's right. what I'm trying to get at. I'm trying to, from a different perspective, is to point out that, yes, we can patch things over in those restructured markets to try to save plants, to try to get new plants built. But it's going to be an uphill battle because of these systemic risks of, you know, spot markets and public ownership, private ownership, that is not possible to have those kind of long-term patient capital that right. is misaligned with those markets. And so it's always going to be an uphill battle. And so, we're all busy. Nuclear advocates are doing great job in the United States. So my only ask is, can you actually do something else? Can you start thinking about re-regulation? Can you start right. thinking about private versus public ownership? Because you will always be on your back foot until you start addressing the systemic issues which are driving the economics of nuclear, given its particular attributes.
And when you say that, one of the things that immediately pops in my head is, well, that patient capital is needed because the upfront capital requirements for nuclear, like with hydropower, are extraordinarily high. You're making this big investment right at the beginning, and you're going to have to wait to get paid out. So we've talked around the issue of capital. In the U.S., I wrote a piece on my Substack a little while ago, and I talked about, was nuclear now, right? Using right. Oliver Stone's headline or his title. But to me, in the U.S., it's regulation, capital, and fuel in that order.
Right.
Is that the right order to think about them? Because the regulatory part of this, I was pointing to the NRC, but
right.
if we broaden that out, it's also regulatory issues around how this asset, how this infrastructure is seen by government as part mm-hmm. of the critical infrastructure as a whole. So, I mean, are those the right three things, or would you reorder them? But that's the way I put it. Regulation, capital, and fuel. Of course, they're all connected, but do right. they all have to be solved at once, or can you make a hierarchy?
Yeah, look, I mean, we're all, an engineer would focus on different things. An economist, I would focus on economic regulation and ownership. Uh-huh. So, which is what I'm trying to do in this blog.
Right.
The other thing, Robert, is with Vogel, 3 and 4, like Vogel 1 and 2, it is a regulated state, Georgia. So that's one thing in terms of that on its column.
Yeah.
We kind of say, yeah, this is new. But the other thing that a lot of people miss or de-emphasize is that Vogel, is a public-private partnership, right?
Right.
Yes, the operating is Southern company,
an investor-owned utility, publicly traded.
Investor-owned utility, but ultimately they own only 45% of Vogel.
Yeah,
just like South Texas,
right?
Right, and just like some of the other ones, Vogel is a 55% public ownership reactor,
right?
And so it's Oglethorpe, it's the municipal cooperatives of Georgia. There's a series of other things that own combined the 54-55%. So again, you have, over the last 16 years, you have an increase, a decrease in privately owned capacity in, restructured markets. And then you have, on the opposite hand, you have Watts Bar TVA in Tennessee, where that's 100% publicly owned. And then you have Vogel 3 and Vogel 4, which are the two new reactors that will come. 3 is already on board. I heard today that 4 is now coming on board second quarter, so delayed another quarter. But again, restructured market, public-private partnership with 55% public ownership.
Right.
And so there's a sharing of risk, there's a sharing of equity between, you know, the operating company, Southern, and then the other ones that are probably don't have the expertise, but they do have the deep pockets, like Austin Energy, for example, like, you know, in your hometown, sure, that owns 16% of Southern Texas.
Right.
Or yeah. South Texas.
South Texas project, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So again, you know, Vogtle is a story of restructured markets, public-private partnership, 55% public ownership. And so,
and one of the key owners, if I can just interrupt, is Oglethorpe Power, because I was in Savannah. In fact, I think it was in November at a Cooperative Finance Corporation meeting, and the CEO of Oglethorpe presented, in fact, on the problems that they had at Vogtle on getting the thing built and the cost overruns and how they had to play hardball with Southern. A lot of that was off the record, but they did agree to allow me to publicize the number. They're gonna pay 13 or 14 cents a kilowatt hour, right? Oglethorpe is for the power coming from Vogtle.
Right.
But they have 38 electric membership corporations. So there's mostly public entities, publicly owned utilities in the South and in Georgia that own Oglethorpe. And then Oglethorpe owns
that
percentage in Vogtle. So that ownership, but it was a way to spread the risk, right?
And that's exactly it. Spread the risk and not have a single entity have to build, like, you know, so that's the, I mean, you know, if one of the reasons SMRs, all the chatter about SMRs is that you need to have smaller units to not have such a huge risk, already in the United States for the last 40 years, people have recognized this and have structured the deals, the equity ownership in such a way to spread that risk.
Right.
Right. Because Oglethorpe would never have built, you know, a 1.2 gigawatt reactor, but they could own, and I'm just looking at the numbers now, Robert, Oglethorpe owns 30%.
Yeah. Right.
Right. The Municipal Electrical Authority of Georgia owns 22%. And, you know, the little city of Dalton, Georgia, kind of like Austin, owns 1.6%.
Right.
And so, and so it's Southern that owns the 45%. So there's a good model of risk sharing.
Right. Patient capital.
Patient capital.
And Michael Smith, the CEO at Oglethorpe, talked about this. He said, look, we've already put all this money in. And there was kind of like, we can't quit now, right? We can't go back to our owners and say, well, we're just going to have to ride off the whole thing. We're going to have to ride this out. But they had to seek the best deal that they could get with that project. So, but let's just talk for a minute just about SMRs, because the other thing that's happening at Darlington, and then because we've been talking for nearly an hour and I want to honor your time commitment. Do you think there's a difference in terms of we're talking about patient capital, we're talking about backing, we're talking about this deployment of technology versus the application of policy, right?
And
technology should, in theory, lead the policy, as I talked about with Brent Bennett on a podcast we're going to publish pretty soon on electric vehicles. But specifically, the technology in nuclear, I'll put it to you simply, is this as simply as I can, should we be focusing on gigawatt scale reactors, or do you think SMRs are more, will find more purchase in the market? Because we're building, GE Hitachi, one of the BWXR, do I have my BWRX? BWRX 300 will be built at Darlington. Will be one of the first SMRs in North America. They're going to build that at Darlington and deploy that. So do you see, as from an economic standpoint, gigawatt versus 300 megawatts or SMRs, do you have a bias toward one or the other, or where you think they will work better in the market?
Look, I think the decision to go for an SMR in Darlington was one of spreading of risk, among other things, right? And so, they already as a government, as a public entity, they're already, like I said, they're refurbishing Darlington. Bruce was, was getting refurbished. There had not been a decision yet on refurbishing Pickering, right. And the decision had to be made what to do with this precious land at Darlington, where you already had approved, right? Like, I mean, you know how difficult it is to get approval, right? So they had approved already for Darlington B, let's call it. So there's Darlington A, which is already built. Darlington B, the plan was, Bryce, 20 years ago, that Darlington B would be built, right? Yeah. And then we didn't have the demand, and so the decision was taken not to build another four CANDUs there. That was the original plan.
Yeah.
But smartly enough, OPG and the government maintained the licensing for Darlington B.
Right.
The site licensing. And so they kept it going with a view to building in the future, right? So then you have the decision as to, if you're going to build, why are you going to build it? And I think what we're seeing now is, for example, 2 weeks ago in Alberta, which is one of the other provinces in the prairies on the west, there was a signing between OPG, which is, the company, the state-owned enterprise here in Ontario that is doing the SMRs, and a private entity, because Alberta is kind of like Texas, it's mostly private, energy-only market, to look into building SMRs. Mm. And OPG also has signed a similar situation with Saskatchewan, which is one of our other prairie provinces, and has had MOUs with Poland and a couple other countries. So I think my take, I don't have specific detailed information, but my take is that one of the reasons that OPG and the province ultimately chose this, an SMR, even though from an economic perspective, one could have gone for a CANDU. Right. But I think one of the reasons, one of the considerations is that they're thinking of this as a potential, export opportunity, right? And so, they've been talking to OPG, to TVA down in Tennessee, right? Like and by the way, the CEO of TVA was the former CEO of OPG.
Uh-huh.
The Ash.
So and this so, is and a so, way for, then I guess to boil it down, OPG was seeing this as a way, develop the technology, spread some of the political risks, spread some of the technology risk, and see OPG and OPG as a leader more broadly. Maybe it would.
Well, that's exactly it. Because there was the decision to do one. We've broken ground. That's going to be operational. Fingers crossed in 2028. That's like around the corner, right? There's a decision to do three more, and what's happening is that the Albertas of the world, the Saskatchewans of the world, the Polands of the world, and other countries, including down in TVA, are waiting to see that first one built to see how it goes. So no one wants to be the first of a kind, Robert. We know this. Vogel is an example of that. They want to see
and the BWRX has the advantage of using traditional low enriched uranium. It's in the fairway for what everybody is familiar with. So it's not a big change over to some different fuel form factor. Hey Lou, the rest of it. So
And so I think that's one of the strategic decisions, was that they were thinking within Ontario, and spreading some of the sort of basically diversification.
Yeah,
and they're also thinking as a first mover, and the strategic advantage for OPG together with Hitachi and GE is in terms of potential expertise, in the same way that, for example, like a KEPCO will do in Korea, where they're the ones. It's the actual public enterprise that goes to the Emirates and builds it, right? And so they have the technology, they know the know-how. I think OPG would like to be able to do that. I don't know if they will, but I think that's one of the strategic considerations, where they want to be, an SMR, a global SMR player.
And they have patient capital.
And they have patient capital.
Yeah. Well, this has been great. Edgardo, I think you've listened to the podcast before. Guests introduce themselves at the beginning. At the end, I always ask them the same question. So what are you reading these days? It looks like you're in your office there. What books are on the top of the shelf or top of the list there that are at hand?
Well, I will get to that. But one of the other things that I meant to mention is I binge watched Juice, your new docuseries.
The new docuseries, yeah.
The new docuseries that you just put out. It's fantastic and great work. So I wanted to say that because I already put out a tweet and it's very sharp. It's great to see a lot of friends and colleagues that you interviewed. I think I've met or know everyone that was there almost. So it was very sharp cinema. Great interview. So congratulations. I wanted to say that.
That's very kind. Thank you.
It was really good.
Tyson Culver did a great job.
That's right. Congratulations, Tyson, as well.
Tremendous job.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and it looks really good. I mean, that's the other thing. It looks really, really sharp.
Yeah.
I don't get to read much fiction. I am between work and this pro bono that I do for Electricity, I'm mostly reading papers. So it's going to be a bit of a boring thing, but I do a lot of academic reading because one of the things I can understand those things, and I try to kind of infuse my work and my advocacy work based on that kind of like robust research. And so much of it is to try to keep myself up to date on what academy is thinking, methods, methodologies, and to see where the gaps are. I mean, this is where this blog comes out. There's a huge gap to look at these systemic issues associated with nuclear in the United States. So that's what I mostly read. I read your Substack. I read Emmett Penny's Substack, excellent Substack. And I listen to a lot of podcasts, obviously Decouple, Titans of Nuclear, Power Hungry Podcast. I was a big fan of Exhaust. I'm now a big fan of Nuclear Barbarians. The list goes on.
Good. Okay. We've talked about the challenges. Obviously, there are many challenges, both in the power sector and elsewhere. What gives you hope?
Still a little, on cloud about this decision. And so, the decision, the idea that, public advocates with research and evidence and energy can make a difference. And I think, that's what Canadians for Nuclear Energy did. Again, shout out to President Chris Kiefer, common friend of ours, who led this charge. Fingers crossed that, we see the refurbishment. But that's just an example where, so many people thought that the decision was done, that it could not be reversed. This is sort of the payoff that one gets, and that is hopeful in democracies. That's what should give us hope about the idea of again evidence-based policy with advocates that are blood, sweat, and tears, and hope that can actually make good policy and have it reflected in government decisions.
Yeah. Well, that's great. And I think that's exactly right. And that, that decision and the revival of nuclear does in fact show that a few motivated people who know what they're doing and can really stay motivated and stay involved can really change things. And so that has been, my cynicism is unbounded, but I still try to balance it with some optimism. So, well, Edgardo, it's been a pleasure talking with you. It took a while for us to get it to happen, but we did. My guest, it's been a pleasure to talk to Edgardo Sepulveda. He is a independent consulting economist. He's based in Toronto. You can follow up on his reporting and his blog. There's a lot of work that he put into looking at the nuclear in the United States and the changes in nuclear ownership and capacity at edcarb.org. He's on Twitter at E_R_Sepulveda. Edgardo, thanks for coming on the Power Hungry podcast. It's been great fun.
Thank you very much, Robert. Look forward to the next time we get a chance.
Good. And thanks to all of you out there in podcast land for tuning in to this episode of the Power Hungry podcast. Until next time, see ya.